And then we have 2 weeks on the history of AEA, which is where we are today, on the second week of the history. So if you weren't here last week, then you missed how it, the very early years, but we'll review it very quickly. So for the next half hour, 35 minutes, I'm going to try and go through this amazing story of how did we ever end up with AA in over 100 countries, with 50,000 AA groups, 2 million miracles of alcoholics recovering. And all of this occurred in my lifetime. When I was born, there was no AA. And now, here we have this most amazing phenomenon. And how did it get started? It didn't get started by the government. It didn't get started in California. It didn't get started with two guys from Vermont, of all things. And that's what we talked about last week, was how this amazing story of a series of circumstances that led to our co-founder, Bill Wilson, who was a stockbroker in New York, being contacted by an old childhood friend of his who was a drunk, who had gotten some sobriety in a movement called the Oxford Group, which was very prevalent in the United States at that time. And he came to call on Bill Wilson, tried to tell him that he also could have this wonderful sobriety, and Bill didn't want anything to do with higher powers or God or anything like that. But as a last resort, when he was strapped into a sanitarium for the umpteenth time and he hit absolute bottom, he sort of cried out in desperation that if there was a higher power, could he please show himself? And he had a very remarkable sort of instantaneous spiritual awakening or personality change, where the desire to drink was lifted from him. He was set free from alcohol, had a very remarkable transition, and he ran around trying to sober up other drunks by telling them about this wonderful awakening that he had, and nobody would listen. As we talked about last week, he'd go into a bar and he'd say, "Gentlemen, you don't have to be drunks anymore. I just was sitting on a bed and I heard a great wind blowing and I saw great white light and it was absolute ecstasy." And people would say, "Oh yeah, that happens to me when I drink rum. I don't need to..." Nobody was listening to this story at all. And Bill went for a number of months and never was able to sober up another drunk. And finally he was talking to Dr. Silkworth. He said, "I'm just not getting the message out to anybody." And the doctor said, "You're carrying the wrong message. The message you should carry in order to help the next alcoholic is exactly the same message that Carl Jung gave to Roland Hazard and that Abby Thatcher gave to you. And that is the message of the absolute hopelessness of the disease of alcoholism. You must communicate in no uncertain terms that there is no way in the world an alcoholic can stay sober on their own. They must surrender. Once that happens, everything else will come in automatically, because the person will then be open to the power of this program. But you can't go out there trying to sell people on this God idea with this great flash of white light, because nobody's listening to that. The real message of Alcoholics Anonymous is powerlessness. And that's what we carry on to this day. We talk about that in the steps, that we don't try to prove the existence of God here in AA, but we try to convince you of the need for God. And then the existence will come in, and you will realize it yourself as you surrender your own will out of desperation, because you have been convinced there is no other way to make it. You just surrender, and wonderful things start happening. Well, in any event, Bill, after some sobriety, went out to Akron, Ohio on a business deal, which subsequently fell through. He was going to get rich, get all his money back on this one big deal. So now he got a drunk in a strange city. The deal fell through. He's broke. He doesn't have enough money to go back to New York, where he came from. And he's standing in the lobby of the Mayflower, and he hears the bar music off to the left and the tinkling of glasses, and he just goes, "I could go in there and be king for a day." And he's tempted to have this drink, And something inside of him, and many people say this is when AA really started, with this thought. He said to himself, I better go find another drunk to help, or I'll get drunk. It had nothing to do with helping the other drunk. It was, the only way I'm going to stay sober is to go find and work with another drunk. And that's what he did. And that's through a series of events that we talked about last week. He was put in touch with one of the local drunks from Akron, who was also in the Oxford movement, going to all the prayer meetings, praying, reading the Bible, but drunk all the time. It was one small thing wasn't working quite right at that particular juncture. And this gentleman, our co-founder of AA, was a surgeon named Bob Smith. And Bill went, and they had this great meeting, and Dr. Bob was only going to meet with Bill for 15 minutes, and they talked for 5 hours. Two drunks, just identifying with each other, telling their story, and immediately Dr. Bob said, man, this guy knows me. I've never talked to anybody who knew how I felt before. And that's what we do communicate in AA, how we feel, what it feels like to be an alcoholic. And so the two of them clicked like that, and when we left off last week, Dr. Bob, after 2 weeks of sobriety, Bill moved in to Dr. Bob's house since he was broke, and proceeded to, they were out going to look for other drunks to sober up. And Dr. Bob came in, told Bill, you know, now that I've been sober a couple of weeks, I realize I have been ignoring my medical knowledge. And I see a medical convention. The AMA is having a big convention in Atlantic City, and I have a thirst for knowledge. So I'm going to go to this convention. And he went off and got drunk as a skunk and had AA's first slip. First slip in AA was by our co-founder, right off the bat. 2 weeks sobriety, went off to a medical convention. I'm sure Bill sat there going, I don't know about this, but off he went, got drunk, came back, got on, was so drunk they passed out in the train and they threw him off at the wrong station. And Bill had to send some people over to get him and bring him back to Akron. And he worked over the next 3 days to taper Dr. Bob off. They had no treatment centers or anything like that, so he'd give him a spoonful of whiskey from time to time, and honey, and sauerkraut, and tomatoes. That was Bill's secret formula for... He had read some book on vitamins and determined that if you're going to sober people up, you need a lot of sauerkraut and tomatoes. So Dr. Bob was... And Cairo syrup. I remember when I came in, honey and candy bars were the big thing, and you just had to have that all the time. But in any event, he got down, and 3 days later, Dr. Bob had to perform surgery. It was Monday morning. He had the patient coming in. And so Bill worked with him through the night, and they got up the next morning, and Dr. Bob's hands were still shaking real bad. So on the way to the hospital, he gave him 2 bottles of beer to settle the hands down. He performed the surgery, and he told Bill, and Bill was waiting at home with Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, and he said, Bill, I'll be there. And he called up after the operation, and he said, I just want to let you two know that it was a success, and I'll be home shortly. And an hour went by, and 2 hours went by, and 3 hours went by. And 4 hours went by, and they started worrying that Dr. Bob was out celebrating the success of his first operation. And when he came in, he looked like a free man. And I'll tell you what he had done during that period of time. He had made a, without knowing, the steps hadn't been written yet, but he had made a complete ninth step. He went around all the people in Akron that he owed amends to, owed money to, owed an apology to, and told them he was an alcoholic and that he was now getting sober, he was sorry, and he would do what it was necessary, and he just cleaned his slate without even knowing that this was going to become the ninth step of our program. But it gave him tremendous peace of mind, and Bill certainly learned from that the value of making these amends. Now we start. So they went out and they worked with some local people over the next few years, and one at a time they would get somebody sober. They started a little group, AA group in Akron where they met. They started one in Cleveland, and Bill went back and got one going in New York City. And Bill came back out in 1937, this started in 35, came back out in 1937 and had the famous meeting with Dr. Bob. Now, Bill, you got to understand, is a promoter, Wall Street promoter. You got to understand the two personality types. I may have mentioned this last week. But Dr. Bob is Mr. Conservative. You know what I mean? They go, Dr. Bob, we have new ties that are coming in this year. No, I'm going to keep this style that's been around for 50 years. I think it's fine. We'll just leave everything the way it is. Bill, he's looking for anything new. I mean, if it's new, I'm in. I've got to promote this idea. And I think I mentioned this last week, that Clancy, my buddy Clancy from the West Coast, had the perfect, captured the personality of these two guys when he said, if there was no Dr. Bob and just Bill was in charge of AA, he would have sold the rights to Hollywood in 1941. And if Dr. Bob was the only one, AA just now would be getting out of Akron. You know what I mean? So they were the perfect balance, and so they got together, and they had a group out there, and Bill and Dr. Bob held this conversation, because it occurred to Bill that they really had found an answer, and that he was a very visionary, and that somehow this was going to reach out to the world, and was going to touch the millions of alcoholics. So they sat down and they started talking about this, and they both became convinced that they really had found an answer. There was no doubt about that. But Bill started saying, look, we found an answer, but when we start adding up the people who have any sobriety at all, at the end of 2 years of steady work, we have about 40 people. At this rate, it's going to take us centuries to even be heard of. We've got the answer, but we're going about it wrong. So let me tell you what I've been thinking about on the train coming out here. I've got a plan for AA. And it wasn't even AA then. They hadn't even named it yet. I've got a plan for this fellowship. And here is the plan. This, ladies and gentlemen, was the original plan for AA. We need three things in AA. One, we need a chain of drunk tanks. The chain stores that just come into Wall Street. The 5 and 10 cent stores, the department stores. And Bill knew a chain. Because hospitals didn't like drunks. They puked all over people. They were noisy. And he'd try to smuggle drunks into where Dr. Bob was. And they had quite a thing going on in that hospital in Akron. But Bill said, no, we can't sober up drunks in regular hospitals. We're going to need a chain of drunk tanks. And we're also going to need, what we need to do is take the 40 guys that we got sober and tell them to take a year off from work and go out and start spreading this message. We've got to get it out there. So the second thing that we need in AA are paid missionaries. So we need to raise money. There's no doubt AA needs big money. So you can see the amount of trouble we're already in as this meeting is taking place. And he said, the third thing we need, we got to write down how to do it. So we're going to have to end up with a book. And Dr. Bob's going, now, Bill, I don't know about this. And Bill said, no, get the group together. So they got together, and there's about 15 people, the group conscience. And he knew even back then, you couldn't go anywhere without the group conscience. Everybody had a damn opinion on anything, even if you're just sober a month. No, I don't think that's the right idea. Got to get your 2 cents worth in there on this thing. So he calls the group together. He said, boys, let me tell you, we got around, there's only 40 of us. We got to get moving, and here's how it's going to be done. Chain of drunk tanks, paid missionaries, and a book. And they're sitting out there going, you're nuts. That isn't how it works. We're going to do this. And so they took a vote. There was a great debate that went on, and they won by about 2 votes. Barely a majority to go with Bill's plan. But unanimously, they said, well, if you got to raise a lot of money, you go back to New York, that's where all the money is, and go raise it. And so he said, all right. And he said, now I got the blessing of the fellowship, I'm going to go back, because I've got a hell of a message. So he spent the next 3 or 4 months in the latter part of 1937 hitting everybody in New York City that he knew. that had money or access to money or influence. He just went, that was Bill's mission, was to go out and raise money. And everywhere he went, people would say, what is this? 40 drunks or sobered up? I think it would be better to give to the Red Cross. Why do we want to help these 40 guys? And they had a reason for, and he went and worked for 4, 5, 6 months and raised no money. Zero. Not one nickel got raised. And one day he thought about his brother-in-law. And he had a brother-in-law who was a doctor by the name of Leonard Strong. Leonard was always there for him. He was one of the few family members who would be there when Bill needed help. So he went to Leonard, and the reason he went to Leonard was he remembered several years earlier that Leonard had told him about a cousin who knew someone who worked for Rockefeller. And he went and talked to Leonard, and he said, isn't it true? You remember, we've got this thing started. And he gave him this whole thing, and Leonard liked the idea. He said, didn't you know someone at the Rockefeller? He said, no, I don't know anybody, but I had a cousin who knew somebody who worked for John D. Rockefeller. You want me to call him? And he said, yeah. So he picked up the phone, he called this person, and his name was Willard Richardson, and he remembered Dr. Strong. And he said, yes, of course I'd like to see you. Come on over. Gave him the room number. And Bill's all excited now, going to Rockefeller Center, up to the 50th floor, whatever it was, and he starts into the room, and it says, Private Offices of John D. Rockefeller. And he's going, ooh, we're getting close to the bankroll. I mean, he could just smell. Finally, something's working right for this fledgling organization. And they go in, and they met with a gentleman named Willard Richardson, who was the closest advisor to John D. Rockefeller. All the projects that came into the Rockefeller Foundation came through Willard Richardson, who would screen them, and he knew Mr. Rockefeller, what he'd like and what he wouldn't. So he sat down, he listened to the story, he said, this is a wonderful story. Would you like to come back and have lunch with me, Mr. Wilson? Oh, yes, yes, yes. So he came back and talked again, and he said, I think this is wonderful. I think I'd like you to meet with some of our advisory people, the local bankers, the head of chairman of the board of the churches, prominent businessmen in New York City. There was quite an array, and they collected these gentlemen together, and Bill gave them a briefing about this, and they all said, oh, this sounds like something spectacular. I think we should approach Mr. Rockefeller with this, but before we do it, we want to check it out. So they sent a little team out to Akron, Ohio, Dr. Bob, and they showed him around to the meetings and what they were doing in St. Thomas Hospital, and they came back with this glowing report. So they finally prepared this whole thing and wrote it up, and Mr. Richardson took it into John D. Rockefeller. Mr. Rockefeller read this, and he said, my goodness, this is a marvelous organization. I am very moved by this. This is one of the serious problems that the world has had, is alcoholism, and I believe that these gentlemen have found the answer. However, it is my opinion that money will spoil it. And therefore, I don't think that it would be appropriate to give any money to this organization. Now you say these two gentlemen, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson, are strapped. So I could put a few $1,000s into the church and they could have a little drawing account and they could draw a few $100 here and there to just get them through. But as far as a policy of raising money, we're not going to do that. So these $3,000, whatever it was, is what they're living on for the next year as they try to come up with some alternative. And they draw on it, pay the mortgage on Dr. Smith's house and a bill just to eat. And Bill's wife, Lois, is working in a department store, and that's the only money coming in. Bill's taking in drunks to his house and not charging anything. So he's got six people that he's feeding and trying to get sober. And so you can see that money is a terrible problem, and Bill's just working on this thing. And while this is going on, in order to raise money, in order to make a little promotion when he'd go in to make a sales pitch, he sat down and sort of dashed off a couple of chapters. One of them was an introduction and then his story. And he had that sort of worked up, and he'd say, this is sort of a beginning of your understanding of what we have. So he had basically two chapters to the big book. He didn't know it was going to be the big book, done, that he was using to raise money. That was what it was for. He decided, and he talked this group into it, that Mr. Rockefeller was wrong, and that in spite of Mr. Rockefeller's decision, what they needed to do was raise money. How could they do it? So this advisory group said, well, you could form a foundation of your own. And then you could use that foundation to go out and raise money. So he said, that's a great idea. Let's call it the Alcoholic Foundation. A wonderful name. And they got a lawyer to draw up this paperwork, and Bill had decided that on the board of directors of the Alcoholic Foundation, that they wanted the non-alcoholics to outnumber the alcoholics, because they thought that would give balance to it. And this was just a sort of the way Bill set up the original General Service Office. Later they changed it, but he felt in the beginning they wanted to have some non-alcoholics on there, and they would be in the majority. And the lawyer said, well, what's the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic legally? How do you spell that out in legalese? And they never could figure that out. You know, how are you going to write down who's an alcoholic and who isn't in legal terms? And it caused a hell of a problem with getting this foundation started, but they got it started, and then Bill went out, now we're going to raise some money and get in there. And he worked for 3 more months and got none. No money. Nobody would give any money. So they decided that the only way was to go back and focus on the book. If we could get the money from the book, that became the new focus for raising money. And so they said, how in the world are we going to get this book and start raising money on it? And they said, well, why don't we form a book publishing company? And Bill said, yes. He had this Irishman promoter who was a real hustler. And so he went to him and he said, what do you think? And he says, we'll just form a publishing company. And Bill said, is that hard to do? Oh, no, it's real easy. You just walk into the stationery store here, you buy a pad of stock subscriptions, you write in the name Works Publishing Company. They came up with the Works Publishing Company because the big book was going to be the first in a series of great works that were going to be written by Bill, who had written 2 chapters. And they took the stock subscriptions and just wrote in Works Publishing. They never incorporated, never did anything. They just bought a pad of stock subscriptions, wrote in Works Publishing Company, par value $25, and brought them to the AA meetings. And they said, boys, here's our chance. We're going to get this book going, rah, 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 and we need you to buy these stock subscriptions. And imagine, you know, trying to sell something at an AA meeting today, but this is before we had the traditions. And so Bill's out there trying to sell these things, and nobody is buying. They're going, you want us to buy stock in a book that hadn't been written yet? 2 lousy chapters? And besides, we don't like the chapters you've written already. We got our own opinion on how they ought to be written. Group conscience. Somebody knew somebody at Harper's Magazine, and Bill went up and talked to the religious editor, gave him a little pitch and showed him the 2 chapters, and he said, Mr. Wilson, you can write a full book like, oh yeah, I could write a whole book like this. Well, we'd be willing to give you a $1,500 advance and to give you time to write the book, and then you'd get your 10% out of the thing. And so they went back, and he wanted to take that, but the promoter said, 10%? This book is going to be big. We want to have it all. We want total control of this book. Stick to our idea of the Works Publishing Company. We'll get it published somehow. But he went back and he started telling the guys, hey, the magazine was willing to give us, Harper's Magazine, $1,500. That's a good sign. Nobody's buying anything. Nobody's doing anything. He's trying to sell these stock subscriptions in the meeting. Somebody got the idea of the Reader's Digest. They knew somebody who knew somebody at the Reader's Digest. So Bill and the promoter went down to Reader's Digest, met with the assistant editor, and they told him the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy loved it. And Bill loved the Reader's Digest because it had a circulation at that time of 12 million. And he knew if he could get a story in the Reader's Digest talking about this new fellowship for drunks with a big plug about the book, that would just sell those books all over. I mean, you know, 12 million people reading about it. And they said, yes, I think it would be wonderful. The man he was talking to down there said, you come back when that book is ready and I'll talk to our senior board. And this is a natural for the Reader's Digest. So Bill went back and he said, look, guys, he said, I've checked the printing cost. We can print this book for 35 cents. We're going to sell it for $3.50. That's 1,000% profit. And we're going to keep one-third for me, the author, one-third for the promoter to go out and promote this whole thing. You're going to get one-third and you return on your stock. It's instant money. And he started making some sales. Now the drunks are, they're listening a little bit and the greed's taking over. And it looked like I might make some money on my thing there. So they're buying, you know, and they'd buy a $25 stock subscription, $5 down, $5 a month. And the promoter's main value during this period, as Bill says, was to go out and collect the $5 a month from the drunks, because that is keeping them in potatoes and meat, you know what I'm saying? That keeps them eating. And this is how they're squeaking out over this next period. And now it's time to start putting more of the book together. And Bill is assembling things, and they decided people would write stories, so they picked a group, I forget how many was in the original book, 30 stories, and they would have them write. If the drunk couldn't write, they'd get a newspaper man drunk to write his story, you know, for him. And so we had ghost writing going on right there in the meetings in the beginning. So they're trying to package this whole thing, but everything was a fist fight. Bill would write another chapter, he'd bring it in. People were looking, oh, goddamn, that's too spiritual. I know, you know, you're doing it wrong. This is, you know, and he's arguing, and he felt like he was a referee in the middle of this rat race of bringing these things. And it finally came down to chapter 5. He'd skirt around and talked, you know, the chapter to the wise and the agnostic and all that, but he had never really sat down and addressed, what is this program? What is it? So he knew he had to face this. And he was sitting on his bed one night, and he was trying to figure out what he was going to say about this. Now, they had stolen, or not stolen, but they already had incorporated in themselves the idea of the Oxford movement, which had 6 spiritual principles that they lived by that were kind of the guiding lights there. And so that was definitely part of it. But Bill had determined that those 6 guidelines had too many loopholes, and the drunks were sneaking out. They were coming in and they'd find a way to go right through there. You know what I'm saying? So he sat down that night and started closing the loopholes. He just said, nah, I got to tighten this up so the drunks can't get through with this one, and I got to do that. And he just was screwing around, and he got through with this readjustment period, and he started numbering these things, and it came out 12. And he just thought that was wonderfully prophetic. It was very biblical, you know, in 12 months in the year, and there's 12 this and that, and he liked the idea of 12, so he kept it. It was not pre-planned, or it just happened to come out 12. And he noticed that he had put God up closer to the front than it had been in the Oxford thing, and he had done a couple of other things he had in the 7th step. Humbly on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings. Anyway, he brings the thing down to, here it is, boys, this is the chapter on how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Well, they started looking at it. You got God too soon. It's supposed to be back in the back. And the next thing, there's not enough God in this thing. You got to have God in every step. This God is the whole thing. And then other people said, no, we don't want any God in there. You just got to talk about powerlessness. Look at this. You got these people on their knees. Stand them up. Out went the humbly on our knees. I'll take them out on the knees. And Bill says, out of this process came the most important thing to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is contained in our 3rd step, which says, God as we understood him. They couldn't agree on God. They wanted more. They wanted this. They wanted that. Somebody said, how about God as you understand him? And it was almost like, who the hell could argue with that? So by default, they came up in the middle of all this arguing with this wonderful thing that we have that allows anyone to come in here. How are you going to argue with that? And it's one of the great things to save us in AA. Whoa, we're running late. Anyway, they finally did get agreement on this. They circulated to the outside. People took a look at it, and they had the mimeographs all ready. And it's time for the big move. The Reader's Digest. So they took the final manuscript down, they got the appointment with the man they had met with down there, and they said, we're here, we're ready to shoot. And the man said, shoot what? Oh, you remember we were here? He said, oh, I remember you guys. Oh, yes, of course. You know, I took that idea into the senior advisory board right after you left, and I couldn't believe it. They didn't like it at all. And they're not going to do it. He said, they're not going to do it? Now they're back. There's no Reader's Digest. They've got all these money that's been loaned. The sheriff is starting to want to foreclose the office. The printer who's printing the books now, with $200 down, he's going to print 5,000 books. And now he's getting worried about his money. And one AA member was able to contact a client of his in Baltimore and borrow $1,500, $2,000, which is exactly the amount of money that carried them through to get the book published in 1939. And as they were getting ready to publish it, the promoter came up and said, there was two things that happened. One of them, the promoter came up and said, I have a friend. You remember the Irishman who took the thing to the Catholic Review Board? He knows Gabriel Heater. And Gabriel Heater had this wonderful radio show, and he always had a little human interest thing in there. He says, we'll get him to interview Ryan on the Gabriel Heater show, and Ryan will talk about the book. And Bill said, all right, but I'm worried about Ryan. He said, he's not too sober. I mean, he's... And they said, you know, you're right. So they got the appointment for Ryan on the Gabriel Heater show, which was 2 weeks later, and a group of AA guys took Ryan to the YMCA in New York and stayed with him with a guard 24 hours a day until he appeared on the Gabriel Heater show, which he did, and the show was wonderful, and the book got plugged. And so the promoter said, hey, the radio show's coming up in a week, and we got $500 left, and this is what I suggest. We do a postcard shower of the doctors in this country, because the doctors are the ones who are going to buy this book first, and then they will pass it on to the drunks. It's a natural. They'll buy this book. And so they spent $500 and sent out postcards to all the doctors they could find addresses on, and the Gabriel Heater show went on. And then they waited. They could hardly wait to go down to the post office box to get all these return cards that are going to be coming in from the drunks. So they waited 3 days, and they couldn't stand it anymore. Let's go down. Let's go down. So I went down and look in the little window, and there's like 10 cards sitting there. And the promoter says to Bill, Bill, for Christ's sake, relax. They can't get all those bags in this little... box, get the postmaster back there to come out here. And they go, and the guy said, no, that's it. So they took him out, and there was 12 cards. 10 of them were from drunk doctors whose handwriting they couldn't even read. You know, it was just... And they got two orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're really in serious trouble. At this point, Bill and Lois got evicted from their home in Brooklyn, put their furniture out in the street. I mean, we're talking about broke. And for the next year or so, AA members gave Bill and Lois a car to use and a summer camp to stay at and $50 a week to get along on. And that's all they had to pull this thing together. What happened? They had not heard from John D. Rockefeller. And we're going to wrap this up in 6 minutes, if you can bear with me. In all these years that had gone by, and I had a word from John D. Rockefeller. And all of a sudden, Willard Richardson called up and said, Mr. Rockefeller would like to meet with you. And Bill went up there and said, oh, here comes the money. And Mr. Rockefeller said, you know, I've been following with great interest this little organization of yours, and I am more impressed now than I was 3 years ago. I really think this is one of the finest things that's ever happened. And I'd like to throw a dinner in your honor, a black tie dinner, and I'm going to invite all of the upper crust. And when John D. sent out an invitation, you went. You know what I'm saying? And so lo and behold, and the newspapers are picking all this up, John D. Rockefeller throwing a black tie dinner for drunks? What the hell is wrong with John D. Rockefeller? You know, and I'm sure they were trying to find out if he was seeing a psychiatrist. But he held the dinner. And all these big shots, bankers and lawyers and investment people from Wall Street, are at this dinner for Alcoholics Anonymous. And they brought in and put some drunks at every table. And Ryan, this is a true story, Ryan was at a table with a group of bankers and the Irishman who had done the radio show. And the bankers turned to him and said, Mr. Ryan, we presume you're in the banking business. And Mr. Ryan said, no, I just got out of the Greystone Sanitarium about a month ago. And this type of conversations are going on at all the tables around him. And the bankers have never had a conversation like this, and they're getting a big goddamn kick out of it. They're just going, goddamn, this is something else. What's this, Rockefeller? What's he got us into here? But they were experiencing firsthand the warmth and the humor and the whole thing of sober alcoholics. And John D. was sick, very sick that night, and his son Nelson Rockefeller came in his place and came up and finally at the end of the dinner gave this speech about AA and how important and wonderful work it's going to do. And they wanted the moral support of these bankers that were here. And Bill had done some calculating at his table. He looked around and he knew most of the people that were there. And just doing quick calculating with his fingers, he figured in that room, and this is back in 1939, was $2 billion. And now came the touch. Nelson Rockefeller gets up in front of this $2 billion and says wonderful things about AA. And Bill's just going, he's going to close now. And he said, and gentlemen, this is a work of love and requires no money. And as Bill said, the $2 billion got up and left the room at that moment in time. He said, but he did say, however, there is certain expenses they're suffering right now, and I'm going to give them $1,000, and the rest of them thought about it later on when John D. sent them a big book with a letter about this. And they said, well, let's see, John D.'s given $1,000. I've only got a couple million. I'll give $10. And so there was this one time when AA took outside contributions, probably about $3,000 a year for the next 4 years. And at the end of that time, we had the Jack Alexander article in the Saturday Evening Post, which just reached everyone. The publicity about the John D. Rockefeller dinner was worldwide. It was in papers all over the world that John D. Rockefeller gave this black tie dinner for Alcoholics Anonymous, for these alcoholics who are trying to get sober. And people's curiosity was just piqued, and they said, well, let me get that book. Let me get, so the orders came in, and suddenly AA is stable, and it just began its tremendous growth, which we now are experiencing today. And Bill looks back later on and said, the greatest thing that was given to this fellowship came from Rockefeller was respect. That was the gift from John D. Rockefeller, because the stigma of alcoholism was immense. And here, a figure who was subject to ridicule when he took that position at that time had said, this is something worth pursuing. This has value to this country. This is a very important event that is taking place. And it just accelerated the acceptance of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles in the world. And so the greatest gift had nothing to do with money. It had to do with love and respect. And that's sort of what our story is all about. The rest of it is just, you've all experienced it in the groups and going out carrying the message to the next person. And I hope you've enjoyed this story, and we're at the end of the time, and we'll see you next week on Step One. How are we doing?
Good.
Way to wrap this up with the Lord's Prayer for anybody who would care to join in. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works.
This is the end of this cassette. Please advance the tape as far as possible for the next playing.